Okay, welcome to Progressive News Network's Environmental Justice Report for this Sunday, or EJR as I call it. I'm Janine Moloff, the producer and host. Well, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about today. First of all, we had a two-week hiatus, mainly because it started out we were having technical issues on Blog Talk Radio, and hopefully we got them ironed out. So while we were having this, going back and forth with Blog Talk, we just took 2 weeks off. This week, it is the continuation of a theme that we've been talking about the last couple of times on EJR, the Environmental Justice Report. Again, EJR, the focus is not only on the environment, but on environmental justice, because as we found, as I've looked into the claims made by climate scientists from all over the world, what we have is big money, the super rich, corporations, and the politicians that they bought out, like, you know, prostitutes on the corner, that are really responsible for a large, sizable chunk of global climate devastation. I'm not going to call it global warming. I know that that's what scientists call it because they're trying to be accurate. They'll come up with a title that the average person can understand. But when people hear the term global warming, I know, especially here in the Midwest, they think, all right, so it got a little warmer. How bad could it be? It doesn't communicate how serious this issue is, how dire the situation is. So I call it global climate devastation, because that's what it is. We are destroying the planet. So this week, before we discussed how, for instance, this climate emergency had been known by the major polluters, specifically the oil industry and fossil fuel. They had conducted studies. By their own studies, they knew this was going to happen. And then they suppressed that vital information and lied to the public as we continue to destroy this planet. And why? Greed. Let's be honest about it. Our government is run by politicians who are little more than prostitutes, let's get honest, and it's run by corporations and corporate heads and the super rich, the 1%, whatever you want to call them, that are addicts. And their drug of choice is greed for power, status, money, whatever. We're being destroyed by addicts, greed addicts. Let's get that straight. So we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. This week, I'm going to discuss how climate scientists worldwide are just blowing the whistle on corporate lies regarding global climate devastation. Now, many of these very renowned climate scientists are plainly stating that the 1.5 degree goal that was in the Paris Accords, that, you know, if we just meet that level of climate pollution mitigation, you know, whether it's zero emissions, whatever you want to call it, or net zero, I think was one of the terms that both Republicans and Democrats, Barack Obama loved it, that somehow it would magically work. And the scientists are just saying, look, they always knew that 1.5 degree goal was never going to be met, given the circumstances of the last several years up till now. And they just said it was nothing but political theater, as government officials did the bidding of the very rich across the globe and ignored and mocked the consensus opinions of these scientists. So now we're facing a global catastrophe that potentially no one could escape. And these scientists are definitively stating that all of humanity must cooperate in order to survive. I want you to take that in for a minute. This is serious, folks. You know, we have a few funny ditties on the show, you know, but this is serious. And this is our big story. Our story number two is going to be, we're going to talk about a case that was actually won by environmental activists in Europe. We also have a very special jackass of the week. This is an Ivy Leaguer, and We also have a very obvious deplorable to add to our list. Additionally, we have two very funny political parodies. So with no further ado, let's get on with the show. I'm going to put my intro on and we'll move to it. Okay, and we're back. I have to give my voice a little bit of a break. All righty. So our first article comes from The Guardian, really great newspaper based in London, one of my favorites, actually. And this one was published just this past week on the 9th, so just a couple days ago on Thursday. It was written by Nemo Omer. And the headline very simply reads, Thursday briefing. I'm sorry. Let me go back here again. Oh, I want to make sure I give credit where credit's due. Sometimes when I download this, it doesn't always, says it skips around. So I want to make sure here. Yep, Nemo Omer. Okay, I got it right. Okay. I want to make sure I'm actually crediting people properly. On this show, we not only attribute, we make sure that everybody gets proper credit. So this was a piece written by Nemo Omer. Hope I'm saying that right. The headline is Thursday Briefing, What 400 Scientists Think About the Future of Our Climate. So there's no pussyfooting around here. And this is part of a newsletter series that The Guardian's running with a reporter named Damien Carrington. But this piece was written by Nemo Omer. All right, so it starts out, and I apologize if I'm a little scattered today. I had to put this together really fast. So, basically being able to multitask is not a strength of mine. So it starts with, good morning. It is a cliche at this point, but the saying that every disaster movie starts with a scientist being ignored feels more painfully accurate with every passing day. It goes on to say, I'm just reading straight from the piece, quote, there is no shortage of scientific studies warning the world of the consequences of the climate crisis and how it will accelerate if the situation does not change immediately. And yet action is slow. Despite the ever-growing mass of evidence, we continue to be the frog in a pot of slowly boiling water. And going on, again, I'm just reading from the piece. Quote, in yet another example of the world scientists trying to raise the alarm, Guardian environmental editor Damien Carrington asked hundreds of them about their thoughts on the future of the planet, and their predictions are predictably harrowing. Many expect global warming to hit 2.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, way above internationally agreed targets. If adequate action is not taken, they warn that the world is heading towards a semi-dystopian future. Okay? So this is actually an interview, apparently. It's an overview of what Damien found out, Damien Carrington. And Omer, wrote for today's newsletter, I spoke with Damien, in other words, Damien Carrington, about why he conducted this survey and what the findings tell us about the future. Okay, so there's a quote here, in depth, 1.5 degrees centigrade is a political game. We were never going to reach this target, end quote. Now, this is a threshold that was part of the infamous Paris Agreement. Now, keep in mind, 1.5 degrees centigrade sounds like it would work. Basically, when you talk about 1.5 degrees centigrade or net zero, for instance, you're saying that we're not going to increase the rate of pollution. It doesn't mean that we stop polluting, nor does it mean that everything's hunky-dory if we meet 1.5 degrees centigrade. 1.5 degrees centigrade was probably the lowest level we could do to avoid a worse catastrophe. I know this may seem like, well, this is insurmountable. It's not. But we have to pull together. Okay. So the politicians and diplomats, Barack Obama loved it, obviously. You know, and the piece goes on to say, the editor of this newsletter series for the Guardian, Damien Carrington, he noticed this, what he called, quote, increasing discrepancy between what is being said at climate negotiations, which largely still tout this, namely 1.5 degrees, as an achievable international target, and what scientists believe is likely to happen, end quote. Now, Damien is directly quoted as saying, quote, scientists were increasingly saying to me, 1.5 degrees centigrade is never going to happen. It's too late, end quote. That's what Damien Carrington was told by the scientists. And, you know, this is, if any of you have noticed, and I don't see how you could avoid it, the crazy weather we've had around the globe, the increase in wildfires beyond what we would normally see, tornadoes, hurricanes, this is all because, this is human-made. This is because we are destroying our environment. It's not guesswork here. The polar ice caps have largely melted. This is serious, folks. So Damien Carrington wrote, according to Omar, wrote to, quote, every contactable lead author or review editor of, okay, let me start again. Quote, this is, Omar wrote this. Damien, in other words, Damien Carrington, wrote to every contactable lead author or review editor of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, report since 2018. All 843 of them, and 380 replied. Goes on to say, quote, their expertise range from political science to the economy, physics, climatology, energy, and agriculture, and among many other fields. The IPCC is an authoritative body approved by all governments to provide reports and recommendations on the climate crisis. Okay, end quote. This piece goes on to say, quote, the responses to Damien's survey confirmed his hunch. Only 6% of the respondents thought the internationally agreed 1.5 degrees centigrade limit, Celsius limit, excuse me, would be met. 80% thought that temperatures would rise at least 2.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Half of the respondents anticipated that it would rise to over 3 degrees. One scientist, Jonathan Cullen, at the University of Cambridge, simply said to Damien, quote, 1.5 degrees is a political game. We were never going to reach this target, end quote. So, piece, again, I'm reading straight from it. Quote, for context, human-induced climate change has resulted in an average rise in warming of 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial level over the last 4 years, which has already led to record-breaking heat waves, floods, wildfires, and other extreme weather events. Damien is quoted as saying, quote, it's possible in some ways to adapt and prepare to protect people's lives and livelihoods from some of these things. But another shocking thing that came out of this survey was that many of the experts think we are wildly unprepared, end quote. This is truly frightening. We're unprepared. Make no mistake about it. And I think with Americans, you know, we don't understand that when Europeans or places of other parts of the world say, well, you know, we hit 40 degrees. It's a heat wave, 40 degrees Celsius. Well, 40 degrees on that is, if you actually look at a table that basically translates Celsius into Fahrenheit, 40 degrees Celsius is 116 degrees Fahrenheit. 30 degrees is, I think, 106 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what you have to understand. And part of this is Americans willfully refuse to change, refuse to educate themselves about the measuring systems used by everyone else in the world. Okay? So this article goes on to say, quote, an unexpected part of the responses to the survey was the level of personal anguish Scientists say they have experienced, with many describing a profound sense of hopelessness and frustration, the lack of urgency given to the growing crisis. Okay, one scientist actually said, quote, "What the fuck do we have to do to tell people how serious this is?" End quote. Good question. So the article goes on to talk about, well, when you go above 1.5 degrees heating, what does that look like? Okay. And this explains, quote, "Climate change is not a cliff edge crisis. Every fraction of a degree the world warms above 1.5 degrees, the worse the impact will be on the planet, its wildlife, and human beings. The inverse is also true, so defeatism is not an option," scientists say. So it goes on to explain that at a 2-degree rise, the upper limit, quote, "the upper limit target for the signatories of the Paris Agreement will lead to even more frequent and more extreme weather events, as well as permanent mass death of coral reefs and the, quote, extensive long-term and essentially irreversible loss of many of the Earth's ice sheets and glaciers." Okay. This, quote, "in turn would potentially lead to irreversible sea level rise. There would also be huge biodiversity loss. Many experts say the 2 degrees is too high of a target for these reasons. Anything over 2.5 degrees is a really catastrophic scenario, according to Damian Carrington." Okay. This is something we have to consider. People don't understand the ice sheets at the polar caps are necessary. Beneath those ice sheets, what I've read is there are huge amounts of methane. Now, methane is actually more damaging to our ozone layer than carbon. Methane would heat up things, and when I say heat up, methane would damage the planet far more than carbon. We're talking exponential level. Okay, think of a number squared or cubed, probably, or more than cubed. That's what we're talking about here. And the article goes on to explain that, quote, "the difference between 1.5 degrees, which is the Paris Agreement, and 3 degrees is stark. The annual likelihood of a heat wave in England is roughly 65% at 1.5 degrees. At 3 degrees, the number shoots up to 90 degrees, end quote. So you need to understand, England doesn't have heat waves, all right? They're pretty much in Northern Europe. They're an island, so they're surrounded by seawater, so they're naturally going to be cooler. You know, anybody who's been near a lake, gone to a lakefront or the beach or whatever, the air that comes off of the water, unless you've had a heat wave, especially off of a lake, you know, pretty cold. Okay, I've visited, one of the Great Lakes, and it was 90 degrees outside, and when you step by the lakefront, it felt like about 65. You wanted a sweater. So it is a big difference. Now, the article goes on to explain, quote, "hotter air contains more water vapor, so there will be more flooding around the world." Goes on to say, quote, "the Amazon rainforest would diminish rapidly during dry seasons. A quarter of the world's population could be exposed to extreme drought." And that's as documented by an article from The Economist. Okay. "And ice caps," excuse me. Okay. Sorry about that pop-up. And it goes on to say, "ice caps, quote, could collapse, leading to uncontrollable sea level rise." Climate Central estimates, quote, that 275 million people live in areas that would be flooded at 3 degrees of warming. Okay. Damian Carrington explained, quote, "megacities like Shanghai or Sao Paulo are going to be below sea level, which will lead to more forced migration." He goes on to say, "the picture that was painted by the scientists I spoke to is one of famines, conflicts, and governments unable to cope with the climate disasters that affect their countries as real possibilities," end quote. I'm going to read that one again because you guys need to understand this. at 3 degrees of warming, not only would megacities like Shanghai or Sao Paulo be below sea level, that's going to lead to forced migration, but also, quote, the picture that was painted by the scientist I spoke to was one of famines, conflicts, and governments unable to cope with the climate disasters that affect their countries as real possibilities, end quote. We're serious about this, folks. If you think you can kind of hide out in a gated community out in the burbs, you're wrong. Or you just, well, famine, I'll just go to Schnucks or Trader Joe's, stock up. There's going to be nothing on their shelves. You need to wake up. Nobody can escape this. But that doesn't mean I'm talking about defeatism. I'm talking about we must change our ways. We just do. Did anyone notice, this is just me talking, not from the article, did anyone notice that in the early days of the pandemic, when worldwide everybody was staying home pretty much, except for, you know, emergency workers, and practically nobody was driving, pollution levels went down drastically. I mean, in parts of Italy that have a lot of pollution, like, let me think for a minute, I forget. The water that was normally gray and dirty and the sky was blue. Just that short hiatus, things started bouncing back, which tells us something. This is not about whether or not you're a vegan. This is not about, you know, whether or not you recycle. Big industry and the very rich have been brainwashing us into thinking that it's every individual's fault. It's not true. I'm not saying that we have to go back to the Stone Age either. I'm not saying people shouldn't heat their homes or cool them. What I'm saying is we're probably going to have to give up our individual cars and just car culture. We need to build great mass transit so people actually drive less. And even if you go to fully electric cars, guess what? How do you think you're producing the electricity? You're still using some kind of fuel. You know, this business that electricity is totally clean, it's not exactly true. And, you know, it's not just, okay, we'll go to electric cars. We need to conserve. We, you know, just because we found a fuel that is polluting less, it doesn't mean we should go back to being like pigs at the trough. We need to consume less. Seriously. This is not about people in my generation. I'm in my 60s. This is about our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. They deserve a better life than what they're going to inherit because of our selfishness, our greed. We must change our ways. You know, and I've had these conversations with friends and family members, and especially with the car thing. Saying, look, we need to build great mass transit. You know, Japan has got high-speed trains. They're wonderful, okay? Here in St. Louis, mass transit totally sucks, and it takes forever to get anywhere. I get that. We need to improve that. But the fact is, when you mention, we're probably going to have to give up our individual cars, drive a lot less, take mass transit, they're going, oh, that'll never happen. That's what I hear all the time. You know, or, you know, when you mentioned that we're destroying the planet, like, well, they'll just say, well, what I hear is, doesn't bother me. I won't be here. And it's like, but your kids will be here. I do not understand this lack of empathy, this lack of consideration, this selfishness. I don't understand it at all. So, and again, I also get mad at people that are extreme environmentalists. I know of one far leftist. And he's older than me, but he's in great shape, and he rides a bicycle everywhere, but he lives several blocks from his employment, okay? So, of course, he can ride a bicycle. And, of course, everybody should do the same thing, and I'm just going, dude, that's not possible. You know, once again, this is something where we have to figure out a way whereby we don't go into the Stone Age. People can heat their homes in the winter, cool them in the summer. reasonable electricity at reasonable rates, because if we keep going the way we are, even if you're middle class, guess what? You're not going to be able to afford it. Why? Because the rich have to have their private jets? Seriously. Nobody should have a private jet. That should be outlawed right there. Those private jets, and I don't care if it's Donald Trump or, you know, a liberal like Taylor Swift, who is seems like a really good person. It doesn't matter. Nobody should have a private jet. That each trip, massive amounts of pollutants into the air for convenience. No, not going to happen. So, you know, once again, the last part of this is saying no time for defeatism, all right? And they write to say, quote, all of this is not to say that experts are advocates of nihilism. In other words, they're not saying that you should just give up. It says, quote, ultimately systemic change is needed to stop the worst of the climate crisis. But in the meantime, the other way of forcing change is through the ballot box, scientists say. For those who can vote, putting their support behind green candidates, especially during a time when other crises have pushed the climate emergency down the political agenda, is one way of making world leaders listen. The more optimistic experts told Damien that making the case clearly that climate positive changes will make everyone's quality of life better is vital. And Damien explained with the following, quote, climate change is a slow motion disaster. It happens bit by bit, and that's one of the reasons it's difficult to deal with. But it doesn't mean that we can wait, end quote. So, take a little drink of my decaf here. Again, this is why we have to really pay attention. Now, the survey that Damien Carrington was talking about, this is a piece that was run the day before on Wednesday, May 8th, okay? And Damien Carrington, once again, is the environment editor at The Guardian. And so this headline says, quote, hopeless and broken, why the world's top climate scientists are in despair. Exclusive survey of hundreds of experts reveals harrowing picture of future, but they warn climate fight must not be abandoned. Okay? World's top climate scientists expect global heating to blast past 1.5 degrees target. Okay? And so we've got some quotes here from some of the scientists themselves. The first one is from a climate scientist, Ruth, I know I'm going to say her name wrong, Ruth Cerezo Mota. And this climate scientist said the following, quote, sometimes it is almost impossible not to feel hopeless and broken. After all the flooding, fires, and droughts of the last 3 years worldwide, all related to climate change, and after the fury of Hurricane Otis in Mexico, my country, I really thought governments were ready to listen to the science to act in the people's best interest. Okay. And that didn't happen. Instead, Ruth Cerezo Mota really does expect that the global temperature will heat to what she calls a catastrophic 3 degrees this century, okay? And this really could create, quote, enormous suffering to billions, with a B, billions of people. And the sad part is this is her optimist. Okay, so that's what she's saying. Now, her optimistic view is the following, quote, the breaking point for me was a meeting in Singapore. There is no safe, no, she goes on to say, I got a depression. It was a very dark point in my life. I was unable to do anything and was just sort of surviving. She does continue her work. She goes, quote, we keep doing it because we have to do it. So the powerful cannot say they didn't know. We know what we're talking about. They can say they don't care, but they can't say they didn't know. So in Merida, on the Yucatan Peninsula, where Cerezo Mota lives, the heat is really going up. She said, quote, last summer we had around 47 degrees maximum. Jesus. Let me explain to you. I got to go to this table. I'm serious. Because, again, it doesn't – so 47 degrees Celsius. Okay, I take it back. 47 degrees Celsius is 116. I got it wrong the last time around. My bad. So she said last summer we had around 47 degrees maximum, which is 116 degrees. The worst part is that even at night, it's 38 degrees, which is higher than your body temperature. 38 degrees is close to 100. It doesn't give a minute of the day for your body to try and recover. She talks about the record-breaking heat waves that led to a lot of deaths in Mexico and said the following, quote, "It's very frustrating because many of these things could have been avoided, and it's just silly to think, well, I don't care if Mexico gets destroyed. We have seen these extreme events happening everywhere. There is not a safe place for anyone. I think 3 degrees is being hopeful and conservative. 1.5 degrees is already bad, but I don't think there is any way we are going to stick to that. There is not any clear sign from any government that we are actually going to stay under 1.5 degrees. So to go further into this, Ruth Sarezamota, which these are her opinions, I just read. She's an expert in climate modeling at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. And at this conference, she listened to other experts spell out the connection between rising global temperatures and heat waves, fires, storms, and floods hurting people, not by the end of this century, but today. And she said, quote, "That was when everything clicked. There is no safe place for anyone." I think that says it. This woman's an expert and they're just not listening. And again, does anyone believe that the wildfires that California experienced the last couple of years were natural? I mean, think about it. They've always had some wildfires, but no, that was way beyond what was normally seen. Okay. Now, according to this piece, this really just a mass interview of climate scientists, they explained that Ruth Sarezamota wasn't the only one that expressed this. Again, they talk about the exclusive Guardian survey of hundreds of the world's leading climate experts. And they found that, quote, 77% of respondents believe global temperatures will reach at least 2.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, a devastating degree of heating. Almost half, 42%, think that it will be more than 3 degrees, and only 6% think that the 1.5 degree limit will be achieved. Let that sink in for a minute. We have been lied to, both by Democrats and Republicans. And I know there's a lot of issues going around. People are worried about Gaza. People are worried about Israel. People are worried about Ukraine. There's a lot of stuff going on. But it won't matter if the planet is destroyed and becomes uninhabitable. And why? Because, what? The rich have to have private jets, and the more modestly rich have to have 5 cars. You know, I'm deviating from the script a little bit, but I remember as a kid, I mean, I graduated high school in 77, and I remember most families had the family car, one. And if you were fairly well off, affluent to rich, you had a second car. So if Junior wanted to drive somewhere on a date, he had to ask to borrow the family car. And you know what? Didn't kill us. We were fine. Seriously, some of us actually rode our bikes to visit friends. Yeah, are you gasped, need I say it, took the bus. I do used to take the bus all the time. Again, we have to change our ways. Now, the past climate researchers, they have really tried to paint a picture of what lies in front of us. And so, you know, this Guardian, this investigation by the Guardian, they talked to experts in atmospheric science, the oceans, energy, agriculture, economics, politics, and most of the scientists there, they were pretty grim. I said before. And again, the future they painted was, to use their word, harrowing. They predicted mass famines. Okay, there's no such, if there's a famine and if you're unable to grow crops in the country, animals die, so on and so forth. There's not going to be anything on the shelves at Trader Joe's. Get it through your thick skulls. The famines, mass migration, conflict, what they call conflict, in other words, wars. One expert was quoted but chose not to be named, who said the following, quote, "I find it infuriating, distressing, overwhelming. I'm relieved that I do not have children knowing what their future," so overwhelming. Another one said, quote, "I'm relieved that I do not have children knowing what the future holds," end quote. And again, the scientists were responding to questions on the survey, critical questions about the future of humanity, things like, well, how hot will the planet get? What will life look like at that point? You know, why is the world refusing to act with anything remotely addressing the urgency of the problem? You know, is it game over or do we fight on? And right now, the climate crisis has already caused profound damage. The average global temperature has reached about 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial levels just over the last 4 years. But according to this piece, it says, quote, "The scale of future impacts will depend on what happens or not in politics, finance, technology, and global society, and how the Earth's climate ecosystems respond," end quote. And they talk about, again, about the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And again, the IPCC got together thousands of experts in all of these fields, and they have produced probably the most authoritative report out there. And this report was approved by all governments. I want you to take that in, regardless of, you know, who they were. The IPCC was founded in 1988 by the United Nations because they were worried about global heating even then, stating that global heating could be, quote, "disastrous for mankind if timely steps are not taken at all levels," end quote. So the IPCC's task, they had to produce this comprehensive review and recommendations, and it has done so six times over the past 35 years. The past 35 years. Keep in mind, one of the world's largest polluters, the United States. Now, the IPCC expert, you know, they are the most informed. So the Guardian contacted every available lead author or review editor of all of the IPCC reports since 2018. Okay. They wanted the most recent information. Almost half replied, 380 out of 843, and that's what we were talking about before. And the expectations that they listed for global temperature rise, to use a word, were stark. One of the scientists, Lisa Schiffer, who is at the University of Bonn, anticipates a 3-degree rise. She said the following, quote, "It looks really bleak, but I think it's realistic. It's just the fact that we're not taking the action that we need to," end quote. So several of the scientists did say that a lower temperature peak was possible, but none of them had any confidence that it would happen. Okay. They're overwhelmingly, these scientists were frustrated and fearful. Another South African scientist who chose not to make, who chose to remain anonymous, said the following, quote, "I expect a semi-dystopian future," we read that before, "with substantial pain and suffering for the people of the global south. The world's response to date is reprehensible. We live in an age of fools," end quote, and we do. And again, look at today's election. Joe Biden, not exactly a green president, let's get real here, but Joe Biden will actually respond to public pressure. And you can reason with the man. I truly believe that Donald Trump is going full speed ahead saying, drill, baby, drill. And Donald Trump just told lobbyists for the fossil fuel industry, it's all over the news, that he will give them what they want if they give him $1 billion with a B in campaign funds. Donald Trump, just among his many crimes, said, yeah, I'll take a bribe. Give me $1 billion and I'll just, we can drill whatever. We know Donald Trump is a fool, but again, you've got all these Ivy League trained businessmen, Ivy League trained attorneys going along with this. I don't think they're stupid. I think they're so arrogant that they think that they can escape it somehow. Seriously. The scientist phrase that commonly pops up throughout this is, quote, running away from it, namely global devastation, running away from it is impossible. Scientists said we are, quote, on a highway to hell. Okay. CNRS Ecology Center scientist in France, Camille Parmesan, quote, let me read this. It's a little weird the way it's phrased. Quote, Camille Parmesan at the CNRS Ecology Center in France was on the point of giving up 15 years ago. She said the following, quote, I had devoted my research life to climate scientists and it had not made a damn bit of difference. I started feeling like, well, I love singing. Maybe I'll become a nightclub singer, end quote. But instead, thank God, she was inspired to continue because she saw the dedication of these youth activists, these youth climate activists, especially at the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009. She said, quote, all these young people were so charged up, so impassioned, so I'll keep doing this not for the politicians, but for you, end quote. So there's some other quotes here. This next one, I'm not sure. They didn't really attribute where it came from. Another anonymous quote is the following, quote, the big difference with the most recent IPCC report was that all the scientists I worked with were incredibly frustrated. Everyone was at the end of the rope asking, what the fuck do we have to do? What the fuck do we have to do to get through to people how bad this really is, end quote. Another scientist said, quote, scientists are human. We are also people living on this earth who are also experiencing the impacts of climate change. We also have children and who also have worries about the future. This is scientist Shipper. We did our science. We put this really good report together, and wow, it really didn't make a difference on the policy. It's very difficult to see that every time, end quote. Another scientist, Jory Rogelj at the Imperial College of London said the following, quote, climate change is our inescapable reality. Running away from it is impossible and will only increase the challenges of dealing with the consequences and implementing solutions, end quote. Henri Weissman at the IDDRI Policy Research Institute in France said the following, quote, I regularly face moments of despair and guilt of not managing to make things change more rapidly, and these feelings have become even stronger since I became a father. But in these moments, two things help me. Remembering how much progress has happened since I started to work on the topic in 2005, and that every tenth of a degree matters a lot. This means it is still useful to continue the fight, end quote. This report goes on to say that 1.5 degrees was a political gain. Now, mind you, the 1.5 degrees target was pushed through international negotiations and the Paris Accords, and it was pushed through by an alliance of vulnerable small island states. And the 1.5, you know, and the, let me go on and say that, quote, they saw the previous 2-degree target as condemning their nations to obliteration under rising oceans and storms, end quote. And you have to realize, the wealthier nations have been absolutely cruelly indifferent to the plight of the South and a lot of these island nations where the majority of people, yes, are communities of color. So yes, environmental racism, I said it, is a big part of this. So is corporate greed. Again, we are a world run by political leaders that are addicts. And I'll say it again, their drug of choice is greed. Why in the world are we tolerating our world, our governments being run by insane addicts who just have to get that next fix of more profit or more status or more power at everyone else's expense? Think. Jesus, I get so frustrated with this. So the 1.5 degrees goal, this was adopted at the UN Climate Summit in Paris in 2015, and everybody bragged about it, right? Barack Obama was, you know, euphoric about it. You know, they called it, quote, a state of true multilateral ambition, delivered with beaming smiles and euphoric applause, end quote. And then, according to this article, quote, it quickly became the default target for minimizing climate damage, with UN summits being conducted to the repeated refrain of keep 1.5 degrees alive. For the target to be breached requires global temperatures to be above 1.5 degrees across numerous years, not just for a single year. Okay, end quote. So they knew it. It was just a political con. We have to hold our political leaders accountable. I don't care if it's a Democrat. I don't care if it's a Republican. If you committed a crime, you should be criminally prosecuted and sent to prison. It's not rocket science here. You know, we have to stop this the system of legalized bribery that we have here in the United States, because we're the biggest polluter. Make no mistake about it. You know, second only to China, perhaps. And so 1.5 degrees remains this political target. And almost all the IPCC experts that The Guardian actually heard from basically said 1.5 degrees is dead. A scientist from a Pacific Island nation said the following, quote, humanity is headed humanity is heading towards destruction. We've got to appreciate help and love each other, end quote. Another scientist, Schipper, said, quote, there is an argument that if we say that it is too late for 1.5 degrees, then we are setting ourselves up for defeat and saying there's nothing we can do. But I don't agree, end quote. Jonathan Cohen at the University of Cambridge was very blunt and said the following, quote, 1.5 degrees is a political game. We were never going to reach this target, end quote. They're basically, the climate emergency is already here. It's been here. Okay, we have seen heat waves, according to this article, from the U.S. to Europe to China that under normal conditions we would have never heard of, would have been impossible. Millions of people have probably died as a result of it already. You know, once again, but a world that is hotter by 2.5 degrees or 3 degrees or worse, quote, as most of the experts anticipate, takes us into truly uncharted territory. It is hard to fully map this new world. Our intricately connected global society means the impact of climate shocks in one place can cascade around the world through food price hikes, broken supply chains, and migration, end quote. We saw what happened during the pandemic. Here in the Midwest, grocery store shelves were empty. And people just going, well, what does that have to do with climate change? Pretty much everything. Not only that, but once the ice sheets melt fully, there's probably any number of viruses that have been made dormant because they were frozen that will be released. Possibly some far more deadly than COVID. And again, remember, COVID was airborne. Yes, it was real. Only a fucking moron doesn't believe it was. And when it's airborne like that, there's no protecting. Winds don't discriminate, baby. It's airborne, you're good as dead. You know, you can't survive without breathing. So once again, the latest IPCC assessment, really, there were hundreds of pages that were devoted to climate impacts. I'm just going to read straight from this quote. The latest IPCC assessment, and you can read it yourself, devotes hundreds of pages to climate impacts with irreversible losses to the Amazon rainforest, quadrupled flood damages and billions more people exposed to dengue fever. With 3 degrees of global heating, cities including Shanghai, Rio de Janeiro, Miami, and The Hague ended up below sea level. That's the 3 degree world. I'll repeat that. Excuse me. I'm talking almost now and my voice starting to give out. Again, with 3 degrees of global heating, and we're going to get there. Cities including Shanghai. Okay, so maybe you don't care about Asians. Rio. Might like going there. Miami. Hello, Florida. And The Hague end up below sea level. According to James Renwick at the Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand, he said the following, quote, "It is the biggest threat humanity has faced with the potential to wreck our social fabric and way of life. It has the potential to kill millions, if not billions, through starvation, war over resources, displacement. None of us will be unaffected by the devastation," end quote. What part of this is not getting through to some of you people? So if you have friends or relatives that don't believe this, all this climate nonsense, you need to get through their thick skulls. Excuse me. Okay? We have another quote here. Tim Benton, who is an expert on food security and food systems at the Chatham House think tank, said the following, quote, "I am scared mightily. I don't see how we are able to get out of this mess," end quote. He talked about the cost of protecting people and recovering from climate disasters would be astronomical. There'd be more discord over delays of who pays the bills. There were lots of experts that were worried over food production. One said, quote, "We barely started to see the impact," end quote. There was another grave concern, climate tipping points. And that is where small temperature increase can tip crucial parts of the climate system into collapse. And one specifically is the Greenland ice sheet, as well as the Amazon rainforest and key Atlantic currents. Quote, most according to Wolfgang Kramer at the Mediterranean Institute of Biodiversity and Ecology, quote, "Most people do not realize how big these risks are." Okay? So again, those climate tipping points, there are certain areas that are really vulnerable, even if they're small, you know, tiny temperature increases. One of them is the Greenland ice sheet. Another one is the Amazon rainforest, as well as key Atlantic currents. And remember, several weeks ago, we had a show about the AMOC, which is the Atlantic current that brings warm air from the global south into Europe. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, places like France and Germany actually have decent springs and summers, you know, why it's not totally Arctic there. And the AMOC is in danger of collapse as well. So if you care nothing about people of color in the global south, Europe and the United States and Canada, they're not going to escape it either. You know, I don't know if we can save all of the world, but we need to save as much as we can. And we need to show compassion and share the resources and stop being such pigs. I'm just saying it. In fact, one of the quotes is here, quote, "All of humanity needs to come together and cooperate." I agree. Okay. The world's response has been shameful. And the IPCC experts, practically all of them to a consensus, pointed to one barrier, and that was, quote, "lack of political will." Okay. It also went on to say, quote, "almost three quarters of the respondents cited this factor." In other words, lack of political will. And it goes on to say, quote, "with 60% also blaming vested corporate interests," end quote. Lorraine Whitmarsh at the University of Bath in the UK said the following, quote, "climate change is an existential threat to humanity, and lack of political will and vested corporate interests are preventing us addressing it. I do worry about the future my children are inheriting," end quote. Lack of money was another concern for about a quarter of the scientists, like 27%. Most of them believe that existing finances really are pushing to a green transition. Few respondents thought that a lack of green technology or scientific understanding of the issue were a problem. Okay. So Louis Verchot at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia said the following, quote, this is the all of humanity, quote, all of humanity needs to come together and cooperate. This is a monumental opportunity to put differences aside and work together. Unfortunately, climate change has become a political wedge issue. I wonder how deep the crisis needs to become before we all start rowing in the same direction, end quote. He's right. Okay. Another one, Deepak Dasgupta is an economist and former government advisor in India who basically talked about how short-term thinking by governments and businesses really was a major barrier, and mentioned how climate action, we really need decades-long planning instead of, you know, planning that lasts 1 or 2 years that coincides with election cycles, you know, because that's really just a con. Another one, Shobha Maharaj from Trinidad and Tobago said the following, multiple trillions of dollars were liquidated for use during the pandemic, yet it seems there's not enough political will to commit several billion dollars to adaptation funding, end quote. And, you know, this is really about protecting people from the inevitable impacts of climate devastation and adaptation funding, helping people adapt to new realities. Another quote, Lincoln Alves from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research talked about how basically how politicians as well as mainstream media and petrostates have been, they're talking about how politicians and the media, mainstream media, have been bought out, have essentially accepted rights, have been bought out by fossil fuel companies and petrostates. And the fact is, it's petrofuels that are the root cause of this climate. Okay, there's no guesswork here. Fossil fuel is the cause, period. And Lincoln Alves said the following, quote, the economic interests of nations often take precedence, end quote. That's a real polite way of saying the politicians and the mainstream media took bribes to hide the truth, because that's what it is, okay? And again, make no mistake about it, fossil fuel is the cause. There's no guesswork here. Another opinion came from Stephen Humphries at the London School of Economics, who said the following, quote, the tacit calculus of decision makers, particularly in the Anglosphere, U.S., Canada, U.K., Australia, but also Russia, and the major fossil fuel producers in the Middle East, is driving us into a world in which the vulnerable will suffer while the well-heeled will hope to stay safe above the waterline, end quote. And he's right on the money, okay? And he does expect that there will be a cataclysmic 3 degrees rise. And when Mr. Humphries was asked what individual action could be effective, he said, quote, civil disobedience, end quote. You know, I all this stuff about Gaza is just the beginning. All right, I wish that all these protesters from Gaza would pay attention to what's harming the entire world, my own opinion. The scientists were also concerned about disinformation. And it was really, this disinformation was blinding people so that they really weren't paying attention to what the scientists said, and that's what disinformation is supposed to do. And Ralph Sims at Massey University in New Zealand said the following, quote, the enormity of the problem is not well understood. So there will be environmental refugees by the millions, extreme weather events escalating, food and water shortages before the majority accept the urgency in reducing emissions, by which time it will be too late, end quote. And that's a lot of it right there, okay? You know, just because it isn't happening here doesn't mean that it's not happening. There's a basically another little subtitle, quote, capitalism has trained us well. quote, fight for a fairer world. Now, that was a message from one French scientist who reflected what many of them were thinking and saying, and talking about really the enormous gap, the wealth gap between the rich and the poor, and that this was a giant barrier to climate action, which also really reflects what he called the chasm between, quote, those responsible for the most emissions and those suffering most from the impacts. And it's true. Absolutely true. Esteban Giovaghi from the University of San Luis in Argentina said, was talked about global solidarity to overcome environmental crises, said, quote, the current growing inequalities are the number one barrier to that, end quote. And it's true. Aditi Mogeri from the CGIAR research group said the following, quote, the rich countries have hogged all the carbon budget, leaving very little for the rest of the world, end quote. And it's true. The global north really owes a debt to the global south. Okay? We just do. There's overconsumption in rich nations. Okay, one U.S. scientist said the following, quote, I feel resigned to disaster as we cannot separate our love of bigger, better, faster, more from what will help the greatest number of people survive and thrive. Capitalism has trained us well, end quote. I think you guys are getting the hang of this now. Hmm. But there's some scientists that come up with a little more of a positive spin, or at least some suggestions. So one of them is Maiza Rojas, who's an IPCC scientist, and also Chile's environmental minister. And Maiza Rojas said the following, quote, we need to communicate that acting on climate change can be a benefit with proper support from the state instead of a personal burden, end quote. And I agree. Here in the United States, we know cars are a big problem. And here in the United States, instead of trying to get people who actually don't need the price, let me explain something. Okay, a couple of years ago, I had to replace the furnace in my house, the heating furnace. And I had friends who meant well. They said, oh, get a solar furnace. I said, I can't afford it. I said, well, excuse me, with the Biden, you know, the infrastructure bill, you know, you can get a price break. So I looked into it. And going by that, I would be able to get a 50% price break. The problem was 50% of that exorbitant price was still way too much for me. And they said, well, try this. I said, I can't qualify, all right? So I wound up getting a traditional furnace. Shaming somebody like me who is lower income is not going to fix the problem. You know, rather than, and here's the thing, here in the United States, people don't realize that the petrofuel industry still gets taxpayer subsidies. Think about that for a minute. They shouldn't, but they do. I would, one, want to take all the subsidies away from the petrofuel companies. That's number one. What I'd like to see happen is for the whatever administration to come up with a plan that if you make, or rather, if you take home less than, say, 80 grand, okay, regardless of how many people in your family, you still only use one furnace, and give people a voucher for a renewable HVAC, in other words, heating and cooling system, it would pay for it all. People would do it. I know what it wouldn't. It's our tax money. That's number one. I'd also like to see our scientists come up with a kit, and I'm sure they know how to do it, a kit to take all of our older cars and basically adapt them and turn them into hybrids, a hybrid conversion kit. Our tax money paid to develop it. And then our tax money, again, if you take home less than 80 grand, you qualify and you get a voucher to turn your car into a hybrid convert. That's it. It'd take a while, but guess what? People would do it. That would cut our consumption a lot. And then put money into mass transit because, again, fossil fuel that's the problem, period. And I know it's a lot of kids, including some that are leftists, they're convinced that it's, you have to go vegan. It's like, okay, fine. What about that brand new shiny car that mommy and daddy bought you when you were 16, when you turned 16? Got to give it up. Sorry. This could work. But again, we have to have the political will to do it. So there's a lot more here, but you get the idea. Okay? So now we're going to go here. I'm going to take a little break for a second, and we're going to move to story number two. Okay, let's do this. So, let me see, I lost my place here, sorry. So our second story is about making the super rich pay. Make them pay for their crimes against the planet, resulting again from their insane quest for profit. The super rich are addicts and their drug of choice is greed to the detriment of all life on Earth. Okay, this is a big theme. So let me backtrack a little bit here. When I was looking for stories, I didn't have time for that. So we have one story here that's an example of that, and it's from, it's Europe Decoded, Euroviews. And it is written by, I know I'm going to pronounce the names wrong, Aratzi Garcia Perez and Mohamed Shaheen. I apologize if they're listening if I mispronounce their names. I tried my best. Euroviews is really seen throughout the whole EU. Now, this is an op-ed. It's an editorial. And they basically say, quote, climate change is not merely an environmental predicament. It is a matter of social justice. Our transition to a sustainable future can only succeed if it brings people hope for the future and leaves no one behind. That's an important one right there. We leave no one behind. So, you know, they're writing about how we have this onslaught of extreme weather events and mitigating climate change just is no longer an option, okay? We have to live with the consequences. And, you know, we have to, these are affecting the most vulnerable citizens in Europe and other regions. And they go on to say, quote, recent findings from the European Environment Agency reveal that Europe is the fastest warming continent on the planet. And you have to realize something, in many parts of Europe, you don't need an air conditioner, not historically, maybe parts of Italy, but otherwise, no. Well, that's not going to be the case anymore. It isn't the case anymore, actually. And climate hazards are affecting, according to this article, everything from energy to food and food security, ecosystems, infrastructure, and public health. It goes on to say, quote, in the European Union alone, floods, devastating wildfires, scorching heat waves and prolonged droughts have already inflicted staggering economic losses exceeding $650 billion with a B since 1980, claiming 195,000 lives. Okay? Now, it goes on to say, quote, according to the same agency, around $520 billion per year is needed to reach the climate neutrality goal by 2050 and to implement the Green Deal. And then it goes on to say, quote, the super rich are in the driver's seat. Well, we know that, okay? You know, this article goes on to explain how lower-income European countries are really bearing the brunt of this. They have higher fatality rates. They have greater economic tolls on their GDP. The super rich, it goes on to say, are driving the climate change. It says, quote, the richest 10% of the global population is responsible for around 50% of all emissions. I'm going to read that line again. Quote, the richest 10% of the global population is responsible for around 50% of all emissions. So they go on to say, basically, reducing economic inequality is essential. I would go on to say, not only reducing economic inequality, but eradicating the the corruption that comes with it. All right, politicians that do the bidding of the rich against what they know they should be doing should be criminally tried and, yes, serve mandatory prison terms. I'm not kidding. They're not going to be deterred by anything else. If the politician is already rich, paying a couple thousand dollars is not going to deter them. It's just the cost of doing business the way they see it. This piece goes on to say, quote, our continent finds itself ill-prepared to confront these mounting threats, and mounting threats we described before. That is why, alongside ambitious climate mitigation efforts, we must enact adaptation policies to shield every European from the costly fallout, end quote. Okay? And they're right. And it's about paying a fair share. Okay? It goes on to say that, quote, sufficient funding for adaptation, this is an important element. It says, quote, people who are uninsured or not well insured are losing their homes because of floods or forest fires, and they need to be protected. Large corporations, big polluters, and the ultra-rich must pay their fair share. Amen. Hallelujah. That's me just talking. We advocate for a permanent investment tool at the EU level to safeguard our social and climate priorities, end quote. Okay? And it goes on to say how the future has to be rooted in social justice. And they're right. You know, they go on and on and on, but you get the idea. We move on to the smaller topic. European Court delivers climate ruling, and this is from law.com international. So for the first time, the European Court of Human Rights has ruled on the issue of state action on climate change. This was April 9th. So this article is about a month old, and it was written by Alex Delia. She's a correspondent in Spain and Portugal. So I'm just reading from the article right now. The European Court of Human Rights has ruled that Switzerland's shortcomings to prevent climate change violated its citizens' human rights, a decision that will set a precedent for future climate lawsuits. It goes on to say, quote, the landmark ruling was one in a trio of climate-related cases considered by the court. It dismissed the other two on mostly procedural grounds. Okay, end quote. So to give you a little background, the case against Switzerland, it was brought by this association of over 2,000 older Swiss women. And they were concerned about the consequence of global warming on their health and living conditions. The ruling was 16-1. That's big. And the court found that, quote, the Swiss Confederation violated a law requiring respect for private and family life under the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 8. The court ruled that this encompasses a right for individuals to protection state authorities from the adverse effects of climate change. In its decision, the court said that Swiss authorities failed to quantify, quote, through a carbon budget or otherwise national greenhouse gas emissions limitations, end quote. The article goes on to explain how Swiss authorities failed to meet their, quote, past emission reduction targets and did not act in a timely and adequate manner to devise, develop, and implement a relevant framework. Okay, end quote. So apparently this is the first time, excuse me, that the European Court of Human Rights has ruled on anything, you know, on climate change involving state action. And this verdict could influence, according to this article, future rulings because there have been six other climate cases that were on hold before this decision. The court also found unanimously, I'm reading from the thing again, quote, let me read from start, quote, the court also found unanimously that the Swiss courts violated the women's rights to a fair trial when the courts considered it unnecessary to examine the merits of the complaints. It held that Switzerland must pay the applicant association $80,000 to cover legal costs and expenses, end quote. So this legal expert is saying this case is going to set a precedent. And apparently, this is one of an increasing number of climate lawsuits that are being brought just by regular people against governments, and they predicate their complaint on human rights law. You know, and it makes sense. You know, here in the United States, we have yet to, well, there's the Giuliani case, but I mean, you know, here in my hometown of St. Louis, you know, here in the United States, you can't, quote, sue the government, but the government is responsible for illegally, for allowing the illegal dumping of radioactive waste at Westlake Landfill. And so we have, you know, basically like a cancer alley here. You know, again, we must hold these politicians accountable. You know, they pick too many politicians. They made their choice. They side with the very rich because that's how they're getting bribed. And, you know, we have to hold them accountable. And I don't just mean civilly. I mean criminally. I'm dead serious. Now, apparently the verdict in the Switzerland case can – oh, no, take that back. Switzerland case was really important because this verdict cannot be appealed. Okay? It is now binding legal precedent for all 46 countries that are signatories to the European Convention on Human Rights. And all I have to say is, hallelujah, amen. Ooh, hallelujah, hallelujah. I know, I'm being silly, but you know, you got to respect these Europeans. They've got some guts. Okay? Seriously. You know, I'm tired with sounding lawyerly. Because guess what? We don't have time for that, and politicians don't care. They just don't. Okay? We're killing the planet and everybody on it. So, you know, there's some obvious opinions here. The court did, let's see, I lost my place here. Okay, I lost my place here, but there's some other cases. So the court apparently, the court voted with these older women from Switzerland, but the same court also deemed two other cases inadmissible, which I find really hypocritical. Now, the largest of the cases involved six young Portuguese applicants. And they charged that 32 European countries failed to protect their human rights from the perils of climate change. Now, these kids, they began in 2017 when there were these deadly wildfires that went throughout central Portugal. And, you know, these kids said, quote, that motivated us to do something for the planet, our health, of course, and our lives because we are in danger. And that's a direct quote from one of the applicants, Catarina dos Santos Mota. Now, in 2020, the case was brought against all 27 of the European Union's member states, in addition, plus Norway, Russia, Switzerland, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and Ukraine. It goes on to say, quote, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the young applicants, now ages 12 to 24, withdrew their case against Ukraine. Okay. Now, these six kids at the time when this first happened, these applicants, they argued their case, that their health, both their mental health and physical, had suffered because of climate change. The response, it says, quote, the respondent states countered, arguing the applicants were asking the court to act as legislators rather than judges. counsel for the United Kingdom, there's somebody named Sudhanshu Swaroop of 20 Essex represented the position of other respondent states, said at a hearing September 27th that the applicants asked the law, I'm sorry, quote, that the applicants asked the court to build a new model of extraterritorial jurisdiction, quote, with the effect that any person on the planet who claims to be affected by climate change could claim to be within the jurisdiction of each and every one of the respondent states, end quote. The court excuse me, sorry about the coughing. The court then unanimously ruled the applicants only have jurisdiction under Portugal, not the European states, the other European states, that is. And that they didn't exhaust their domestic. In other words, the court said, look, you only have jurisdiction under Portugal, the other European states, you don't have standing to sue here. You didn't exhaust all the possibilities for a remedy domestically in Portugal itself before you went to the European Court of Human Rights. Well, again, talk about being lawyerly, right? Liarly, lawyers, liars. Anyway, but you had a senior lawyer at the Global Legal Action Network, Jerry Liston. Oh, I love Jerry Liston. Apparently, Global Legal Action Network and Jerry Liston, they're the nonprofit behind this case of these Portuguese kids. And Liston said the ruling against Switzerland is a, quote, massive win for all generations, end quote. And he also noted that it meant that all European countries have, they better quickly revise their targets so they're science-based. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with, but at least there was a little bit of, you know, a say. Okay. Sorry about the coughing. We're about to get to our jackass of the week. And we're back. Okay. So now we're going to get to our jackass of the week. First, we have to listen. One of my fun parts. Here we go. Welcome to our Jackass of the Week Award. Spray on, Jack. This week we have a very special jackass, an Ivy Leaguer, no less. Okay, I love that. We have, like I said, we have an Ivy Leaguer jackass this week, and this goes to, this Jackass of the Week Award goes to Ivy League Trump attorney and Attorney General, Republican Attorney General candidate here in Missouri, Will Sharpe. Let's give it up for Will Sharpe once again. There we go. Come on, Jack. Bravo, Will Sharpe. You are our jackass of the week. Okay. So Will Sharpe is an interesting study, okay? First of all, he's part of the legal team that is at the Supreme Court and argued that presidents deserve absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, period. Period. They tried to whittle it down a little bit, but that's what they're arguing. The team is, you know, everybody here is DJ and John Sauer's name, okay? But they don't mention the other two lawyers, and one of them, is, and they're all St. Louis attorneys, too. That's the other thing. So D. John Sauer is a native St. Louisan. He's the lead counsel for this asinine case. And then you have Michael Talent. Now, Michael Talent is the son of former governor and senator Jim Talent. And, you know, Jim Talent always tried to present himself as this moderate mainstream Republican. Bullshit. Okay, I used to believe it, not anymore, because this kid, Anyway, and then you have Will Sharpe. Now, all three attorneys are Ivy League trained, because I'm actually finishing an article right now. Michael Talent is a grad of the Stanford Law School, and Sauer and, yes, Will Sharpe are grads of the Harvard Law School. So Will Sharpe is also campaigning to be the Republican nominee for Attorney General here in Missouri. I don't know why. You know, he's only been here a couple of years. He grew up in New York. He's not a Midwesterner. But I saw him at a town hall just a couple of days ago, and the incumbent Attorney General, who's also a Republican, Andrew Bailey, didn't show, but the Democratic candidate, Elad Gross, did. Elad's wonderful. But Sharpe, you know, not only being the one of the attorneys that pushed the absolute immunity crap for Trump, Sharpe also pushed multiple lies of omission, half-truths, and downright damnable lies at this town hall meeting. And it was at St. Louis University. Sharpe attacked public schools while pretending to support them. Okay, he made multiple things. He talked about crime, how St. Louis is, you know, crime capital of the country, you know. And I know Mr. Sharpe, he's smart enough to know that these are racist tropes. Crime, schools, you know, the underlying message is these black people are going to get you. It's nonsense. So he not only did do that, but of course the migrant crisis. Sharp blamed migrants of color for increased crime and fentanyl smuggling. And he did this with, you know, laid-back attitude, which apparently Sharp assumed would make him more palatable to Midwesterners. You know, he showed up in jeans and a little more casual jacket. Eli Gross showed up in a suit. Okay. But, you know, rich people think that, okay, I just need to look folksy, so I'll wear a pair of skinny leg jeans, which on his skinny legs look really bad. I'm just going to tell you right now, those are chicken legs, but I shouldn't get personal. But, you know, the thing is that facts are stubborn things, and there were so many lies I could point to, but I found this one. This one was really good. You know, and Mr. Sharp should have checked himself before making these vague blanket statements and accusations. So I chose the fentanyl epidemic, you know, where he's just blaming migrants of color, illegals that are bringing fentanyl into the country. Except for one thing, like I said before, facts are stubborn things. And I found an article from the Cato Institute, C-A-T-O. Now, the Cato Institute is hardly a bastion of liberal anything. It's very hardcore libertarian. It's hardly part of the radical woke left, as Sharp puts it. Now, according to, and the Cato Institute, just to let you know this, is, and this is their description from their website. This is not Janine Moloff attributing this. This is their description from the Cato Institute website, and it reads as follows. Quote, the Cato Institute is an American libertarian think tank headquartered in Washington, D.C. It was founded in 1977 by Ed Crane, Murray Rothbard, and Charles Koch, chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Koch Industries. Da-da-da. Okay, Charles Koch got his nasty hands into this. So, you know, it's, I'm tired of calling it conservative. You know, this is authoritarian far right. So, you know, it had to kill them to publish this September 14th, 2022. By David J. Beer, okay, and I'm just going to give you a little information about Mr. Beer, spelled B-I-E-R. David J. Beer is the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute. He is an expert on legal immigration, border security, and interior enforcement. So he's one of those, you know, he's going to agree with Mr. Sharp, right? Here's the headline. Fentanyl is smuggled by U.S. citizens. I'm sorry, let me start again. The headline, I read it wrong. Fentanyl is smuggled for U.S. citizens by U.S. citizens, not asylum seekers. I'm going to read that again. Written by Mr. Beer, okay, head of immigration studies for the far right Cato Institute. Quote, headline, fentanyl is smuggled for U.S. citizens by U.S. citizens, not asylum seekers. Here are the facts, and I'm reading straight from this. I found the, you know, the bullet points. Quote, fentanyl smuggling is ultimately funded by U.S. consumers who pay for illicit opioids, nearly 99% of whom are U.S. citizens. And that is documented by the NCBI, NIM, in other words, National Institute of Health. Okay? In 2021, U.S. citizens were 86.3% of convicted fentanyl drug traffickers, 10 times greater for convictions, I'm sorry, 10 times greater than convictions of illegal immigrants for the same offense. And that is from the USSC.gov commission data files. Point number three, over 90% of fentanyl seizures occurred at legal crossing points or interior vehicle checkpoints. Let me start again. I'm getting too excited, starting to stutter. Point number three, over 90% of fentanyl seizures occur at legal crossing points or interior vehicle checkpoints, not on illegal migration routes. So U.S. citizens who are subject to less scrutiny when crossing legally are the best smugglers. Okay, and that's as documented by CBP.gov, Border Patrol, by the way, in case you don't know. And this last one, oh, same thing, okay. Point number four, the location of smuggling makes sense because hard drugs at ports of entry are about 97% less likely to be stopped than are people crossing illegally between them. Point number five, just 0.02% of the people arrested by Border Patrol for crossing illegally possessed any fentanyl whatsoever. I'm going to read that one again. Point number five, just 0.02, okay, that's 0.02% of the people arrested by Border Patrol are for, just 0.02% of the people arrested by Border Patrol for crossing illegally possessed any fentanyl whatsoever. Point number six, the government exacerbated the problem by banning most legal cross-border traffic in 2020 and 2021, accelerating a switch to fentanyl, the easiest to conceal drug. Point number seven, during the travel restrictions, fentanyl seizures at ports quadrupled from fiscal year 2019 to 2021. Fentanyl went from a third of combined heroin and fentanyl seizures to over 90%, and that's, again, from Border Patrol, CBP. And point number eight, annual deaths from fentanyl nearly doubled from 2019 to 2021 after the government banned most travel and asylum. Okay? So, Mr. Sharp stood up there and he rattled off alleged facts that weren't facts. And I guess he was so arrogant, he figured that nobody in an internet age would check. And again, this isn't from some wild liberal checkpoint. This is from the Cato Institute. You know it bugged them to say this. So for that and so many other reasons, Trump attorney, Will Scharf, arguing for presidential immunity, is our jackass of the week. Pray on, Will, pray on. Oh, you never sounded better, sweetie. Yeah. Okay. All righty. Let's move on. Okay. All right. So I'm going to take another little break here to get to the next little story. And we're back. I think my voice might last. Now we're at our deplorables list. Got to get the evil-sounding music going. Give me a minute here. Our deplorables list this week, our deplorable is South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, otherwise known as the Puppy Slayer. Okay, so by now everybody's heard about it, because that little moron, she bragged about it in her book. She had a dog several years ago. And she, in her book, talked about killing her dog, Cricket. And the Poynter Institute wrote a piece on May 3rd and published. And the headline reads, "Did South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem break the law by shooting her dog? What legal experts say?" And, you know, I guess it depends on the state you're in. You know, she talked about how, you know, she hated that dog. It was untrainable and dangerous to anyone she came in contact with. She had to put her down, yada, yada, yada. Okay, and it's a 20-year story. It's what experts have said about these laws. The law, well, you know what? The laws of South Dakota permit, quote, the euthanizing of dangerous animals in certain circumstances. And this is according to Justin Marceau, a University of Denver law professor. He's also the director of the school's animal law program, Animal Activist Legal Defense Project. Marceau goes on to say, quote, but Governor Noem has failed to note the determinations about whether to euthanize an animal are, by statute, assigned to peace officers and humane officers, not pet owners, to determine it would take extra work or money to properly train a young puppy. You know, there's experts who say that animal cruelty laws likely didn't apply. Here's the thing. I'm not going to get into all this. What I'm going to say very simply is this. She could have given the dog to a shelter that would train him, foster, whatever. This dog was a bird dog. It was untrained. She took it to a hunt, and the dog put bluntly went apeshit because it was untrained. And then after the hunt, and it was all wild and wound up, attacked some chickens. And then her way to euthanize was to take it to a pit and shoot it and let it suffer. First of all, that's not how animals are euthanized. All right, they're put to sleep. Secondly, you know, Kristi Noem pointed this out because she thought she was going to have her old Yeller moment, you know, like poor Yeller, you know, Yeller developed, according to the Disney movie, came down with rabies, and they loved the dog, it was a great dog, but they had no choice. Okay, that's one thing. This is not an old Yeller moment, okay? This is somebody who is clearly a vicious sociopath who lacks empathy, who the dog irritated her, so she murdered it. And that's it. So for that and so many other reasons, I'm going to go back to our evil music. Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota is added to our deplorables list. She is truly evil. Anybody that would hurt an animal, you know, they say people that hurt animals, innocent animals, are also people that would hurt other people. I've had dogs that were hard to train. I trained them. I didn't murder them. So for this reason, our deplorables list, Governor Kristi Noem, puppy slayer and all around evil bitch. Okay. All right. All right. So now we have, we're at the end of our show. I think my throat will key up. We have two ditties this week. Now at the end of the show, I like playing a couple of political parody songs. I couldn't find anything new from Randy Rainbow. So we have two. One is Two Lies, and it is a play on the song from Fiddler on the Roof, Two Lies, Lie, I'm Two Life, except that it really mocks Trump. The second one is from a group called both are from a group called The Founders Sing. The other one is The Supreme Court for Sale. Okay? So we're going to do the first one, which is Two Lies. I hope you enjoy it. Give me a second here.
Pervasive fraud. Defamation, to hush money, and election interference, and votes importance. For life, we'll try him. We'll try and get him again for life. He is a dictator, one to be, threatening democracy. Let's convict him for life, we'll try him. We'll try and convict him for life. He fucked around and he's finding out a sentence for lost flout. It's conviction for life. Trials are meant to seek for justice, even when we know he's evil to the core. We'll redeem our faith in justice when we see that Trump is locked behind the door. For life, we'll try him to stop his fascism. That's right. Should be punished for all his sins, and when Joe Biden wins, take the coyote's life.
Okay, so that was number one, you know, and Blassinger singing MAGA, okay? I hope you enjoyed it. And this is our last one because each one's a little shorter. And this is from the founders saying it is the Supreme Court for sale. Hope you enjoy it. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed our show today. I hope you learned something. We're probably going to do more of EJR. And, you know, we have so many disasters coming at us all at once. But I know there are times when it's just easier and maybe even self-serving and better for each of us to just turn it off and just say, look, I just want to live my life. I get it. I do. But we can't. This is not just about us. This is about the world that our children and grandchildren will inherit. I think part of the problem is that for too long we've had corporate governance. And I remember the first time I heard somebody who was in business say this infamous quote, we've all heard it, you know, when they're giving you bad news or firing you or whatever, they say, it's nothing personal, it's just business. The problem with that is that breeds indifference. It should be personal. That's just it. You know, when you say it's personal, okay, when you say it's nothing personal, it's just business, you're basically giving the powerful a license to be indifferent so they can continue what are policies that are just nothing but cruel and greedy. That's it. So with that, I hope what I say, I hope you learned something. I'm tired. If you like the show, please spread it on Facebook, Twitter, or X, whatever you call it now, all social media, because again, this is a live show. You know, we don't charge anything. So if there's bloopers, again, this is a live show, period. You know, help spread the word, because we're going to continue to, as the saying goes, speak truth to power. With that, I say good night, and by whatever you believe in or don't, bless you.